Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, I'm Steph.
I'm Alex.
And this is Not Today.
And we're live.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm better than ever.
And why might that be?
Well, if we're doing our good thing at the top.
And I think we are.
It just feels silly to not, like, to wait until the end to, like, it's such big. We got engaged.
Yes.
Yay, we were engaged.
Proposed. A lot of planning came to fruition. I'm so happy.
Yeah, me too.
And it went well.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
And, I don't know. Couldn't have asked for a better weekend.
It was the best. Yeah, we spent the weekend with our friends in Traverse City, Michigan, which is beautiful. And we can save the rest of the conversation for the good thing at the end, because I feel like if that's not our good thing, then do we even have a good
thing?
Then
what is?
Yeah. What is a good thing? But yeah, it felt like too big of news to like wait till the end to say it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's good news. But today we're going to be talking about a submarine escape.
Okay.
I don't think we've ever talked about someone escaping from a submarine.
We told the story about somebody escaping a ship.
Yeah, but they were saved from the ship. That was Harrison Ojegba Okene. And
people forget.
No. People do not forget. People tell me to tell that story so often because they don't know that we already told it. But it's a crazy story. I understand why they want me to tell it. For those of you who aren't familiar, the story is about a man who is in a boat that goes down really, really quickly, and he gets like trapped in an air pocket at the bottom of the ocean, and he's there for 3 days, and this like diving crew comes down to recover bodies, and they find him in the like air pocket that they didn't even know existed, and he's just alive down there, which is crazy. But so yeah, that's an insane story. But this one is different because this man himself escapes from the bottom of the ocean.
Oh, I'm very intrigued now.
Yeah, I can't imagine a worse place to be for myself other than a cave, meaning being in a submarine. Those are probably my two worst places, is a submarine and a cave.
Space?
Well, I mean, I'm not realistically going to go to space ever, but I feel like a cave or a submarine is far more attainable, and I really could never.
Okay, but I am saying I think that would terrify you more.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
I think so, but I'm not going to be an astronaut, so.
You're not?
No. Sorry, you want the ring back?
Yep, it's over.
Yeah. But anyway, you want to get started?
Yes, I'm very intrigued.
Amazing.
I will stop and say it is hilarious how many stories you tell at the beginning where you say, this could never be me. This is my biggest fear. I will never be this person. I will never go there.
But I'll tell the story.
But here we go.
If there's one thing I am, it's a storyteller.
It's true.
So I can do that for you, but personally, I will not be in a submarine anytime soon.
I'm not a story liver.
Yes, okay? Exactly. I love living vicariously through other people.
Yes, maybe getting anxious about it.
Yeah, most definitely getting anxious about it. So I think it's pretty safe to say that life on a submarine really sucks. They're usually super cramped, claustrophobic, they smell bad, and you can go weeks or even months without seeing the sun. The only thing worse than living on a submarine is sinking to the bottom on a broken one. During World War II, the clear waters of the Mediterranean were a death trap for British submarines. Some were bombed from the air, others were hunted with sonar and depth charges, however most collided with underwater mines. 2 out of 5 British submarines that entered the Mediterranean during the war would sink. Usually when submarines would sink, it would become a massive metal coffin for everyone on board. Throughout the course of the war, the British Navy lost 79 submarines, and from those, there were only 4 escapes. Which meant if you went down in one, your odds of escape were 5%.
Yeah, that's bad news.
Yeah.
Well, when they sunk, I mean, were they just kind of blown up, or wouldn't there be a hole in it? You just drown?
Yeah, so if it hit a mine, then part of the submarine would have explode open, and then water would rush in, and there would be like a fire usually, and smoke.
A fire?
Yeah, because there's like electrical things.
Oh, yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
But it's just like, oh, we're underwater.
Well, yeah, not the entire thing would get flooded at once. So it would fill with like fire and smoke and terribleness. And then it would sink to the bottom and everyone usually would die. And think about it, 79 submarines, and all of these submarines had a crew of anywhere between like 60 and 80 people.
They're that big?
Yeah.
I was envisioning like 5 people.
Oh, no.
Okay, so this is a whole, what do you even call it? Platoon?
Yeah, it was like a crew of people doing things for the Navy and, you know, war things. I don't know. They're doing war things. They're
fucking shit up.
Well, they're being spies. I don't know. They're getting supplies from point A to point B, or people. They're doing war things.
Yep.
Anyway, the most remarkable of these escapes took place on December 6th, 1941, when HMS Perseus plummeted to the seabed and 31-year-old John Capes escaped his watery grave. The HMS Perseus was a British P-class submarine built in 1929. At the start of the war, she was operating under the command of Commander Peter Bartlett on the China Station as part of the 4th Submarine Flotilla, with other members of her class. Many warships have a crest or ship emblem, and Perseus had a dragon with a sword driven into its mouth. In 1940, the Perseus was assigned to Alexandria in British Egypt, and their main objective was to covertly transport supplies to the island of Malta, which was where they had a British outpost in the center of the Mediterranean. On the 26th of December 1941, the sub left Malta back to Alexandria for more supplies, with the side quest of patrolling the waters around the island of Greece. On board were 61 men, 59 of which were crew members, and 2 of them were passengers, including John Capes. John Capes was a leading stoker, basically an engine room engineer, with a long history of being on submarines, serving on the L-34, the Thrasher, and the Olympus, which was the sister ship to the Perseus. John Capes was described as tall, dark, and handsome, and a bit of an enigma. Capes had been educated at Dulwich College and was the son of a diplomat, so he naturally would have been an officer rather than one of the mechanics who looked after the engines, but he enjoyed being an engineer.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
In 1940, before boarding the Perseus, while John's submarine was stationed in Malta, he rented a car to tour the island with his friends. And while he was driving, he hit a horse and cart on the island. And he got in trouble for this. And a few months after the accident, the Maltese courts began proceedings and John was required to be there. By that time, Malta was under siege by the Germans and Italians, so he was smuggled in by the quote-unquote magic carpet service, whereby British submarines were used to deliver supplies and personnel around the Mediterranean.
Wait, they took the time during a war to bring him back to Malta to stand trial for hitting a cart?
I think he never left Malta. Like, after he hit the cart, he had to stay there and, like, go to court for it.
Okay, but you're saying the magic carpet service brought him there.
Right. I guess before he hit the cart, he was brought into Malta.
Okay.
Yeah. But
Guys, there's bigger things going on.
Right. Yeah. They're like covertly bringing him back to Malta just to stand trial.
Yeah. Like, who cares?
Yeah. Not great. But it had taken actually a really long time for all these court hearings to take place. I guess there were like multiple of them. And his admiral became tired of waiting for all these court dates. So he decided to send John to Alexandria, Egypt to just continue his service. They were like, no, we're not doing this anymore. You're done. And so he was told he would be traveling to Alexandria on board the HMS Perseus as a passenger. However, on board, they hit some really bad weather. And like I started this story off, life on board the submarine really, really sucked. No one has ever claimed that life aboard a submarine was luxurious. Even on the most advanced warships on the planet, life can still be cramped. Though today amenities are much improved, the sailors patrolling the oceans in World War II had a much different life than their modern counterparts. For one thing, the submarines of World War II were much smaller than submarines today. In that small space, the submariners, some 60 to 80 people, had to store themselves, their gear, and their provisions for 75 days. Each crew member had only about 1 cubic foot of personal storage space aboard the submarine. Each crew member also had a bunk scattered throughout the many compartments of the boat, including in the torpedo rooms. As many as 14 men crammed into the forward torpedo room, along with 16 torpedoes.
So they're sitting right next to all the bombs?
Yes, they're sleeping next to the bombs.
Damn.
A submarine of that size simply could not fit all of the necessary provisions for a long war patrol in the appropriate spaces. So to accommodate, the crew started to stash boxes of food and other things anywhere it would fit. The showers, the engine room, even on the deck, until there was space inside to fit it all. And I'm not sure if this applies to the British submarines, but at least in the US Navy, there was one upside. Because of the dangerous and grueling nature of submarine duty, the Navy did its best to ensure that submariners got the best food the Navy had to offer. They also found room to install an ice cream freezer as a small luxury for the crew.
Really?
Yeah.
They brought ice cream. Well, I guess there's that.
Yeah. They're you like, have to well, live on the ocean floor for like a month, but you get an ice cream.
Hey. That vanilla swirl. Do they have a cherry swirl?
I really hope. They were like, this is the best food the Navy has to offer, which, I mean, who even knows if it's any good, but...
Could you imagine? Like, they don't even have chocolate.
That would suck. Unfortunately, there wasn't much time or space to enjoy their food. Most of the time, the men were lucky to get 10 minutes to eat, as the boat's three shifts all had to pass through the tiny galley in a short amount of time. The serving of food was oftentimes also dictated by restrictions on the submarine's movements. Submarines were under strict orders not to surface during the day to avoid aerial observation and attack. This meant that submariners stayed submerged during the day and only surfaced at night. In order to compensate, many crews flipped their schedules during their normal daily routines at night. The crews called this going into reversa. And this allowed the crew to take advantage of the time the sub was on the surface. So they really never saw the sun. Like, they were asleep and underwater during the day. And then at night, it would surface. And then they would be able to, like, kind of be outside for, like, a second.
I don't know how you live like that. You got to be taking vitamin D or something.
Or something. But they have ice cream.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's war, you know.
Yeah, it's not gonna be not glamorous.
Yeah.
Once the submarine dove after running its diesel engines for hours, the boat would quickly heat up. The engine room temperature could soar to over 100 degrees before spreading throughout the entire thing. Combine that with 80 men working and breathing, and the air inside could quickly become very foul. The men knew the air was getting bad when they had trouble lighting their cigarettes due to lack of oxygen.
Are they smoking down there?
I guess. But isn't that ridiculous that they were like, oh, this is bad because we can't light our cigarettes. Not like, oh, we can't breathe oxygen. It's like, yeah. Oh, the fire won't ignite our cigarettes.
I mean, who cares if we can breathe? I mean, that's why. So can you still breathe if you can't even light a cigarette?
Probably not very well. There's definitely a very small amount of oxygen.
How are they is it like a plane, like pressurized cabin that keep recirculating it?
Probably.
I don't know.
I would assume. But to make matters worse, there was little water available for bathing, and on long patrols, most men only showered every 10 days or so.
That is foul.
Yes. Stinky.
Yeah.
To say the least. Laundry was, of course, out of the question. Because of these conditions, submarines developed a quote-unquote unique smell.
I mean, I guess they could jump in.
Jump in? What do you mean?
The ocean.
there
at night
underwater.
They surface at night.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, you're right. But also, like, dark water in the middle of the ocean. I don't think you're going to jump into that.
Get a rope.
Figure it out.
Jump in with one of those buoy things.
Go swimming. Try it out.
I'm not even joking. Show me the flaw.
I don't think anyone did that. That I know of, at least. Who knows? So you developed a unique smell, a combination of diesel fuel, sweat, cigarettes, hydraulic fluid, cooking, and sewage.
Mm. Yum, yum, yum.
Yummy. On older submarines, the World War I era S-boats, often referred to as pig boats, the conditions were even worse. Without proper ventilation, the odors were even stronger. This also led to mold and mildew throughout the boat, as well as rather large cockroaches that the crew could never quite seem to get rid of.
Cockroach? They're at the bottom of the ocean? They have cockroaches.
Yeah, I don't know how that happens, but they got in somehow. And if the conditions themselves weren't bad enough, it was super dangerous to be on the submarines because so many of them were sunk, killing everyone on board.
What a hellhole.
Mm-hmm.
And then the chances that you die on top of it are just... I mean, is this where they send the worst people?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think it was just like what you were stationed in. Like, you're in the Navy, you know?
Yeah, but how do you... It can't be as bad on the other ships, right?
What do you mean? Like
the
above,
conditions cannot be as
like
bad.
Like the ones that float rather than sink?
Yeah. Or the ones that have air and sun. Right.
Oh, yeah, I would assume. Know. Yeah, because you can at least be outside and air out your stink. Like, even if you can't shower, you get fresh air. But, like, they don't get fresh air in there.
Yeah. So my point is, this is clearly one of the shittiest assignments you can have.
I agree.
How do you decide who gets the shittiest assignment?
I'm sure they're not, they're not picking that themselves. I would be surprised if that were the case, but I mean, who knows? I certainly don't know how it gets divvied up. I'm not in the Navy, so who knows? But it does sound very bad. During the night of December 6th, Capes relaxed in his makeshift bunk in an empty aft torpedo rack in the rear compartment of the sub, reading and sipping from a bottle of rum. Perseus was patrolling on the surface in the dark and recharging her batteries off the southern coast of the Greek island of Kefalonia, when suddenly it hit an enemy mine and an enormous explosion shook the sub, plunging it into darkness and sending her nose first almost straight down until it came to a halt 171 feet below the sea level on the ocean floor. Water rushed in through a great crack in the front part of the ship caused by this enemy mine. When the explosion sunk Perseus, there had been people on watch in the conning tower since they were on the surface. And a submarine's conning tower is also known as the sail. It's a raised, watertight platform that serves as the submarine's navigation and attack center, and it's located above the control room and connects the bridge to the submarine's pressure hull. The conning tower is often armored and is the primary steering station for the ship. From the conning tower, the officer in charge can control the submarine's movements by giving orders to those responsible for the rudders, engine, lines, and ground tackle. But the explosion did some real damage to them. I can't even imagine how terrifying that must have been because they were on the surface and then they just plunged into the deep. I mean, it would have been terrifying for everyone, but like they can really see what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, to just be aware how screwed you are before...
Plummeting, yeah. And I think for most people, like, I don't think the explosion did so much damage that, like, everyone was killed instantly in this explosion. It was like, it just broke a hole into the submarine, and then it sunk really fast, and then people just drowned and, like, exploded. It was bad. And from what I understand, Perseus was a very big submarine, and it shouldn't have been in those waters. It should have been in the Pacific Ocean. So potentially because of its size, it would have had a harder time navigating the mines, which just made it even worse for everyone on board. John Capes wrote in letters that the boat twisted, plunged, and hit the bottom with a nerve-shattering jolt. Capes, who had been thrown out of bed, was now in pitch-black darkness. Thankfully, after stumbling and feeling around a bit, he found a flashlight stored near the aft escape hatch, which is at the back of the ship. The first thing he did was use the flashlight to begin searching for other survivors. and through the darkness, debris, and rising water level, he went forward into the engine room after passing by the corpses of at least a dozen mangled crew members. The engine room would have been the farthest he could go because the door leading to the next part of the ship was closed, and Capes could tell that it was holding back, basically the sea. The pressure on the other side was tremendous. The streams of water leaked through the rubber seals. He said it was creaking under the great pressure. Jets and trickles from the rudder joint were seeping through. Capes did manage to find three injured stokers amongst the engine room's debris and corpses and helped them further back to the stern compartment. After the explosion and the sub hit the ocean floor, Perseus was now killing the few men that were left alive inside. Smoke and poisonous gas filled every compartment, and with each breath the men took, they used up what little oxygen they had left. Thankfully, though, Capes had been an engineer on Perseus's sister ship, so he knew this sub very well, which helped them in the escape. The three men made their way to the escape chamber and hatch that was just above the engine room, where they discovered pairs of escape suits. Capes had located four Davis submerged escape apparatus sets and helped the men put them on before putting one on himself. He went very, like, flight attendant on them.
Oh, yeah.
The Davis Submerged Escape Apparatus, also referred to as the DSEA, was an early type of oxygen rebreather invented in 1910 by Sir Robert Davis. While intended primarily as an emergency escape apparatus for submarine crews, it was soon also used for diving. Being a handy shallow water diving apparatus with a 30-minute endurance and is an industrial breathing set. So it's great in shallow water, but it's not really intended to be used at that depth, so they were screwed, kind of.
Well, it's the best shot.
Well, yeah. The apparatus itself comprises a rubber breathing slash buoyancy bag, which contains a canister of barium hydroxide to scrub inhaled CO2, and in a pocket at the lower end of the bag, a steel pressure cylinder holding approximately 56 liters of oxygen at a pressure of 120 bar. The breathing slash buoyancy bag is connected to a mouthpiece by a flexible tube, and you breathe through your mouth only. The nose is closed using a clip, and goggles are also provided as a standard part of the apparatus. So you're basically just breathing in it through a tube in your mouth, and your nose is clipped, and you got on like regular goggles.
All those words for that?
Yeah. I'm sorry.
No, I'm kidding. I'm just saying, like,
I'm being descriptive.
You are.
Thorough.
Wait, so they don't have a suit?
No, it like kind of looks like a leather briefcase that you put around your neck, and then you've got like a tube that goes into your mouth that's connected to what looks like the briefcase, and then you have like essentially a chip clip on your nose and goggles.
You have a chip clip?
You have a clip. Something's holding your nose closed.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
But these escape suits were only tested for a maximum depth of 100 feet beneath the water, which meant they only had enough oxygen for that amount of distance.
Wait. I thought you said they were rebreathing. Are they not, like, blowing out CO2 and then it takes the oxygen and they breathe it back in?
I think they had just enough oxygen for 100 feet.
So tank run out, you're fucked.
Correct. So they only had 100 feet. Of oxygen, as we've established. However, their depth gauge showed that they were 270 feet below the surface.
Good luck, guys.
Yeah, it would almost surely be a suicide mission to try to get to the surface at that depth. But actually, the gauge was wrong. They were actually 171 feet under the water, which was still deeper than what they thought they could survive using this breathing apparatus. So they would have to swim for 71 feet with no oxygen. But that was technically better than what they believed they would have to swim, because they thought they would have to swim 171 feet without oxygen.
Yeah, I guess how long does it take you to go feet?
I certainly don't know. But point being, nobody in history had ever done that before. They would be breaking the world record attempt for the deepest ever escape if they lived.
Well, could you imagine that's the pep talk? Guys, we could also survive and break a Guinness Book World Records record today.
We could be really cool, you guys. Not only could we live.
Can we get a judge here?
Can we have someone waiting on the surface, please? Yeah. Anyway, time and oxygen inside the sub was definitely running out. So Capes took one last swig from his bottle of rum, and from there it was time to go. In order to open the escape hatch, the pressure inside the sub had to be the same as the outside, which meant they needed to flood the compartment. Capes located the starboard bilge valve, but it was bent and it wouldn't budge, and then he remembered the submarine's underwater flare gun, which was used to send smoke signals to the surface. So from the things that I've gathered, he either used that to get the hatch open, or he just took it with him. But either way, he flooded the compartment. The sea came gushing in, and slowly the water level began to rise around them. Capes made sure everyone had their mouthpieces in and their nose clips on as the water filled the compartment, compressing the air at the top. He managed to undo the damaged bolts that had been holding the escape hatch closed, and with a great hiss, the hatch flew open as the trapped air escaped. And from there, Capes pushed out the other three men into the darkness before he went out himself.
Question.
Uh-huh.
Do they have a flashlight still?
He does.
Does it work?
So even with his flashlight, the water was very dark and murky, and he could only just get a small glimpse of Perseus lying slightly tilted on the seafloor.
So low vis.
Low vis. Very low vis.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was another huge issue. Swimming up rapidly to the surface from a depth of hundreds of feet would be a dramatic change in pressure on all of their bodies, which they knew would likely induce the bends. The bends, or decompression sickness, refers to injuries caused by a rapid decrease in the pressure that surrounds you of either air or water. It occurs most commonly in scuba or deep sea divers, although it can also occur during high altitude or unpressurized air travel, which I didn't know.
Oh, like when the cabin pressure goes away, the masks come down?
I don't think it happens very often in like commercial flight, but it apparently can happen from flying too. But I had only ever heard of it from scuba diving, which is I found very interesting. But anyway, when you scuba dive with compressed air, you take in extra oxygen and nitrogen. Your body uses the oxygen, but the nitrogen is dissolved into your blood, where it remains during your dive. And as you swim back toward the surface after a deep dive, the water pressure around you decreases. If this transition occurs too quickly, the nitrogen does not have time to clear from your blood. Instead, it separates out of your blood and forms bubbles in your tissues or blood, and it is these nitrogen bubbles that cause the decompression sickness. The condition is called the bends because the joint and bone pains that you experience can be so severe that you double over, so you're physically bending.
Okay, that's interesting. I was wondering why they called it that.
Yeah.
So yeah, what? That sucks.
Yeah, that sounds awful.
I mean, can you die? I mean, yes. I imagine if you have bubbles forming in like your heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can die.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What happens inside your body during decompression sickness is similar to what happens when you open a carbonated drink. When you open the can or bottle, you decrease the pressure surrounding the beverage in the container, which causes the gas to come out of the liquid in the form of bubbles. If nitrogen bubbles form in your blood, they can damage your blood vessels and block normal blood flow. So symptoms of decompression sickness include joint pain, dizziness, headache, difficulty thinking clearly, extreme fatigue, tingling or numbness, weakness in your arms or legs, a skin rash, and in extreme cases, death. Joint pain is the most common symptom for decompression sickness, and it can last for days or weeks. As desperate as he was to reach the surface, Capes slowed his ascent as much as he could to keep the pressure from building up and bursting his lungs. But the buoyancy bag of his breathing apparatus lifted him a lot quicker to the surface than he was trying to achieve. But at the same time, he also was going to run out of oxygen and needed to get to the surface. So it was a very delicate balance. So despite his efforts, he became dizzy and the pain in his chest became extremely intense. Every breath he took hurt more and more the closer he got to the surface. When he didn't think he would make it, just then he broke the surface and he was able to take a breath. But his nightmare was far from over. Using the little light he had from his flashlight, he searched for the other men, but none of them had ever surfaced, so he was on his own. Off in the distance, Cape saw the line of white cliffs. Using his breathing apparatus as a makeshift life vest, he began swimming toward the cliffs, hoping the other men had done the same thing. But this swim would not be easy, because Capes would have to swim 5 miles to get there. After a few moments of despair, realizing that his other men were not with him, he started this 8-hour swim toward the faintly visible cliffs of Kefalonia. 8 hours.
At least the water's kind of warm. It's not the Arctic.
Yeah, I guess.
Look on the bright side, okay? Yeah.
How bad Jesus. Could it be?
It's pitch black, 8 hours. There's a current, I have to imagine.
It's still 8 hours of swimming, 5 miles toward cliffs of the place that your enemies are occupied.
Oh, yeah. This is enemy occupied?
Yes.
Well.
Well, he had no other option.
Yeah, I mean, you have no other option. Like, does he have a life vest?
Well, his breathing apparatus kind of kept him afloat.
I guess there's that.
Yeah, he was using it kind of as a life vest. But somehow, he did manage to get there. Because hours later, he was found washed up on the beach beneath the cliffs of the southern coast of Kefalonia. Fishermen from the nearby village of Mavrata found him and hid him in a nearby cave. At the time, the island had been occupied by the German and Italian army, and Capes was forced to hide from them, and the local people would be killed for helping him if they were discovered, so all of their lives were in danger. Rumors had begun swirling that the local people had sailors that they had found on the shoreline, so German and Italian soldiers were looking for them. If he had been found, he would have become a prisoner of war, but the local people would have been shot and killed. But despite that threat, the Kefalonian people still helped John Capes, and not only did they hide him, but they nursed him back to health. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, I mean, this is super brave.
Yeah. For the next year and a half, the islanders, at a great risk to themselves, cared for John. They moved him from house to house and village to village around the island, keeping him hidden from the occupying German and Italian forces. In order to blend in with the people, he dropped 70 pounds, grew a beard, and dyed his hair black.
Was he, like, pudgy or just muscle? Like, lost muscle?
I guess I don't know what type of 70 pounds he lost.
Well, I'm just I'm trying to get a picture of what it would look like to blend in with the locals. Like, what did the locals look like?
He was probably, like, a very muscular, like, built man. Because he was in, you know, the army / navy. I don't know. He was doing his thing. And, yeah, I think he just slimmed down to, like, look like a villager type.
Okay, fair enough.
So, feeling a little bit safer, John sent a postcard to his mother, who at that point believed that he was dead, along with the Perseus crew. He couldn't write much, but he basically said all is well, and he let her know that he was alive. At one point, he was given a donkey, and the only condition was that he does not eat the donkey. So the villagers gave him a donkey to, like, blend in, and they're like, just don't eat him, okay?
Dude, don't eat him.
Yeah. So he used that donkey to scout his surroundings, studying checkpoints and locations to soldiers and their vehicles. But in the meantime, Capes' mother, after reading this letter, informed the British Army that he was still alive, and they were skeptical, but they passed that information on to MI9. MI9 was a branch that was located in Alexandria, Egypt, and they handled resistant operations in Greece. There was a unit that engaged in pulling out sailors and pilots from behind enemy lines. The man who formed MI9, Michael Parrish, used his contacts in Greece to confirm that John Capes was alive and in Kefalonia. And with the assistance of MI9 agents and his new papers, he would have to pass through several checkpoints to get to the rendezvous point to get him out. So after receiving these fake documents, he would go from being a prisoner of war to a spy, meaning he was no longer protected under the Geneva Convention, and if he was caught, he would be subject to the death penalty.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. Workplace stress is now a leading cause of declining mental health, with 61% of the global workforce feeling it more than ever. You can't escape work, but you can take small steps to take care of yourself. A walk, some sun, a favorite song. Therapy is one of those steps. Ongoing support to build resilience for whatever your day throws at you. Balance is tough. Getting help shouldn't be. Visit BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com today to get 10% off your first month.
Finally, after 18 months, on May 30th, 1943, in a plan organized by the Royal Navy, Capes boarded a small fishing boat which smuggled him 400 miles to Smyrna, Turkey. There, he presented himself to the British consulate and was taken to Alexandria, Egypt, where he was free. Capes returned to service in the Royal Navy and later received the British Empire Medal for his exploits. He retired from the Navy in 1950, and for his heroism, he was awarded the British Empire Medal. But when Capes told people about his story of survival, almost nobody believed him. Two-fifths of the subs that ventured into the Mediterranean were sunk, and when a submarine sank, it became a communal coffin. Everyone on board died. That was the rule. Capes' story was so fantastic that for over half a century, most people doubted his claim to have escaped or even have been aboard the submarine, mainly because nobody should have been able to reach the surface alive at the depth he claimed they were at. His estimate of where the HMS Perseus went down did not square with the Royal Navy's estimate, and some even thought he was an imposter and wasn't on the sub at all. His name apparently didn't appear on the crew list when it departed from Malta, and the British submarine commanders were previously ordered to bolt their escape hatches shut from the outside in order to prevent them from getting blown off during a depth charge attack. Which seems crazy to me, because how can you use an escape hatch if it's bolted from the outside? But, you know, whatever. I guess that was a thing.
I feel like the point was, is if you do blow up, everyone's going to die anyway.
Sure, I guess. And there were, of course, no witnesses to back up his story. And also, he had a reputation for being a great and natural storyteller. So people were like, this man is lying.
Damn, he should have had a podcast.
Yeah, I'm a great natural storyteller. Well, that doesn't matter because I didn't escape from a submarine, so.
We could make up a story.
I could, but I'm not gonna, and neither did he. And that's the point.
Damn it, nobody believed him.
Damn it, John Capes did survive. A note that was attached to his file said, "The whole of this escape should be treated with reserve, as there are various incidents difficult to account for. Three different authorities who all saw this man separately are doubtful of the whole story. There is no other means of checking the facts, and it is possible that this man, who was only taking passage in Perseus, may have been on the bridge or in the control room and got out before she sank. At the same time, there is no direct evidence that his story is not in substance correct." It was also said that his story would change as the years went on. So people were like, uh-uh, I don't think so, John Capes. Until the day he died in 1985, some considered him a complete fraud. Dozens of vessels passed by that area having no idea what took place there in 1941, and it wasn't until 12 years after John Capes' death that anyone believed his story. In 1997, 12 years after Capes died, his story was finally verified by Kostas Thaktourides. Oh, that's a hard last name.
If we butchered it, we're sorry.
I am sorry. He discovered the wreck exactly as John Capes had described, including his empty torpedo tube bunk, as well as his bottle of rum, and everything. Like, everything was exactly as he said it was. On December 26, 1997, Greek divers discovered the HMS Perseus under 52 meters of water, several miles from the island of Kefalonia. The cracked hull of the bow was consistent with a mine explosion. The rest of the hull is in good condition. Her gun, her steering wheel, and everything else is in place. Her compasses, which are still working, show her last course, and the escape hatch on the stern compartment is open. Further dives revealed no bodies in the stern compartment and an empty bottle of rum and, like I said, a bunk in the torpedo rack. The depth gauge incorrectly showed 82 meters or 270 feet instead of the actual depth, which was 171 feet. So when John told people his story, he said he swam 270 feet to the surface, which sounded absolutely impossible, but he didn't know that the gauge was wrong. So when they found the sub, everything started adding up. He hadn't actually swam 270 feet. He swam 171, which was still impressive, but way less unbelievable.
Yeah.
John Capes would have set a new record for surviving a shipwreck. 12 years after his death, he was finally vindicated. Isn't that crazy? It sucks that he didn't live to see the day, but at least now we know.
Yeah. I mean, that had to be one of those things where it was like, you know.
Yeah.
You know what happened, so forget about the haters.
You know what I mean? I guess, yeah, first instance of forget the haters and just...
I don't know.
Live
what
your life.
I mean, what do you want him to do?
It just...
like, I was there.
Yeah, it just kind of sucks.
Did you serve in the war?
Could you imagine going through something so traumatic and unbelievable and whatever, and like, it really happened to you. You really did that. And then you go to tell people, and they're like, yeah, okay, John. Okay.
Yeah. That would piss me off.
Yeah, it would piss anyone
Your
off.
Your whole life. Up until the day that you died.
Yeah. And until 12 years later. You know, even his ghost didn't get the vindication until 12 years later.
I know, he goes back and haunts whoever's still alive. It's like,
seriously.
Just like little,
I told you so.
Yeah, it was just like the most subtle signs of I told you so.
Oh my God. Yeah. So the
you know what? He's probably listening to Chapel Roan right now.
What are you even saying?
I told you so.
Oh, that's actually you a know? Good. Thank you for saying that.
Right?
How fun.
What's her song?
Good Luck, Babe.
That one. She's got a bop.
We're getting off the rails here, but I agree. John Capes would have loved Chapel Roan.
I don't know why, but I don't even picture this man as British. I just picture him with, is it the transatlantic accent?
Yeah.
I was like, oh, this Chapel.
Chapel Roan,
see?
Yeah. Anyway, we're really getting off the rails here. All right, so the experienced diver, Kostas, who found the HMS Perseus, said, when I first saw the picture of the submarine on the sonar display, my heart leapt. A wreck is not just a mass of steel, but has many human stories. We approached respectfully in order not to disrupt the final resting place of the 60 souls who drowned that night on December 6, 1941. I feel a moral obligation to ask divers not to remove anything from the wreck. The Perseus is resting on the sandy bottom, almost upright, with a slight right tilt, 18 degrees. The hole that was caused by the explosion of the mine is visible on the left side of the bow, the only visible damage to the steel hull with a length of almost 90 meters. The manhole from which John Cape escaped is still open, while inside the submarine, broken instruments and clutter attest to the violence of the explosion that sank Perseus. The remains of the drowned sailors are scattered across the submarine's floor. Divers found the anchor of an Italian mine close to Perseus, which would appear to be the cause of her sinking. British authorities had assumed that this was the cause, but it had never been officially confirmed. Today, many certified recreational divers visit the wreck of the Perseus, which is now a popular diving destination in Kefalonia.
Wait, is it a tourist attraction now?
Kind of. Well, yes and no. Like, you have to be a very experienced diver to, like, be able to go. But yes, you can go and see it. If you are an experienced diver.
Damn.
Dive conditions on Perseus vary from day to day. Seas can be rough, and currents can have varying strengths at different depths. Operators PADI, Dive Centers, Blue Manta, and Pirate Divers Club offer trips to the HMS Perseus for experienced divers with a deep diver specialty certification. And if you're wondering when the best time to go is, September and October, if you want to go see the Perseus. So anyway, On May 19th and 20th of 2000, memorial ceremonies were held in Kefalonia in honor of the Perseus crew. They were attended by relatives of the deceased, including John Cape's daughter. Members of the submarine Old Comrades Association, locals who hid Capes, and members of the crew who transported Capes to Turkey. And so now there's a memorial, and that's really where the story ends. But I was looking at this article where someone said that they worked with John Capes. And so a man named Ian commented that he worked with John Capes. He said he was the most unassuming man you could meet, but very impressive to look at with a large beard. He rode an old motorbike and always wore an old army greatcoat, which would fly out when on the bike. He was such a nice man, as was his wife, who also worked at the factory. I knew nothing of his escape until it was featured in a Sunday paper one weekend, and he never spoke about it when I knew him and no one knew anything about him. So I guess he probably told people about it and they were like, yeah, no, that did not happen, John. And then he just stopped talking about it. But apparently he was a lovely man, as was his wife.
Yeah, it was just funny the way that you said it. It was like, he was a lovely man and so was his wife. Like, his wife was a man too. I was like, okay, trans in the 40s?
Oh my God.
It's Pride Month, okay? We gotta get the story.
It's true. No, but they were saying that John Capes is a cool guy. I also thought it was funny that multiple people described him as tall, dark, and handsome, an enigma of a man.
Well, didn't the one guy say he was unassuming?
Yeah, this guy said he was unassuming, but then he also was impressive to look at with a large beard.
I don't know what that those two are opposites to me.
Well, probably not in his looks, but unassuming in that he's just a normal dude and you'd never know that he escaped a submarine and got an award.
I see.
You know?
Okay.
Yeah.
But you do like to look at him.
But you like to look at him.
Sometimes a little too much.
Hey, he's a looker. Why not?
You know?
Exactly.
The beard does wonders.
It, you know? Hey. Anyway, that's the story of John Capes. Isn't it crazy? I mean, tell me I'm wrong.
Show me the lie.
Show me the lie. It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to relive the story through his experience. And the whole time, the only thing that I can really think about is the darkness.
Oh, God. Yeah, pitch black. And I mean, thankfully he found that flashlight, because if he hadn't, who knows if he even would have found the escape hatch or anything.
Yeah, true. No chance.
He did know the submarine well, which is good, but I mean, who knows? That's terrifying to think about.
Even a little harder.
And yeah, also, I mean, not only is he in the dark submarine, but then you have to swim out into the pitch black ocean floor. It's nighttime. And also, does the sun even go that deep anyway? It doesn't even matter if it's the daytime. You're at the bottom of the ocean, bro.
100%. And then you don't even know how close you are because it's so dark. It's just prey.
Well, exactly. Yeah, you don't know how close you are. And also, he thought he was going to have to swim 270 meters. 270 feet, not meters. That would have been crazy.
Meters, feet. Does it matter?
Well, yes, it does, because it's vastly different. But
I mean measurement. The number. It's just a number.
270 feet is what I meant. But still, that would have most certainly killed him if that were the actual depth he was at. So thankfully, that was wrong. But isn't that also interesting that his gauges were wrong, and he, you know, in his story, he's like, I swear 270, I saw the numbers. And then they find the submarine at the bottom of the ocean and the gauges still say 270.
Yeah. I'm surprised they stayed the same.
Yeah.
The whole time.
It seemed like it was in really good condition when they found it.
That's hilarious. But all those years and the sub got blown up. It's been at the bottom of the ocean for 50 years. But here's an alternative theory that I think could be funny.
What?
He lied initially and he knew it was 170, and over time the gauge was wrong enough to be his lie.
I don't think that's what happened.
I probably not, but how hilarious would that be if that was the case?
Yeah, he just kept stretching the number and I was like, 270, I swam that far.
Yeah, his story changed from 230 upwards.
Yeah, no, that's definitely not what happened. But I do wonder how his story changed a little bit, because they said that over the years his story changed a little bit. But maybe he just remembered different things, or I don't know, memory does change. But it doesn't mean it didn't happen to him. Like, it absolutely did.
Yeah, but I mean, I understand why they think that he's lying.
Well, yeah, me too. I don't think that they were necessarily wrong for thinking that. Like, it is an absolutely unbelievable story. And he set a record. Like, he set a world record for, like, diving or something, you know, and a deep water escape. So, like, it's very unbelievable. So, anyway, I'm glad that it all got sorted out and they now know that he wasn't a liar, even though it had to happen 12 years after his death.
They gave him a medal. I hope he had a good life.
Me too. And that's the story of John Capes.
Yeah, I think that's all I have to say about that.
Me too. All right,
what's
your good thing? Hey, what's your good thing this week?
Well, in addition to the thing, I did not golf.
It was so funny when we were, so I guess Instagram saw the engagement first. If you follow me on Instagram, you saw it. But someone commented on our post that they were like, and I bet Alex's good thing will still be golf or something
I laughed. I was like,
it was so funny. I was like, you know what? You're not too far off. But yeah, so here we are. Is your good thing golf?
No.
Or is it me?
It's you. Thank you for saying yes.
Yeah, well, thanks for asking.
I have to say that I killed it.
You played it cool.
Even though there was some details that were like, okay.
Up until the very last moment, you played it very cool, I will say. But at that point, once we were there, it did not matter that you were not playing it cool, because then you asked me to marry you 2 seconds later. So you can be not so chill in that moment.
Yeah, I was like, if she knows for 3 seconds, we're fine.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to know anyway, so.
Yeah, but I mean, the whole week, I was really holding it all in.
Yeah.
And I really wanted to, like, tell you things along the way.
Right.
Because.
And believe me, I wanted to know.
Yeah. So, I mean, I kept telling you that I was going to golf,
mm-hmm.
which is completely not out of the ordinary for me.
No.
But I was going to buy the ring.
That's so fun. Hey, so all those golf good things that you had lies. In the past, they were kind of lies. Well, they weren't, but you know.
I would go and then I would actually go golf.
Yeah, I'm sure. Because then you'd have to be gone for like hours. So you're like, might as well just go golf. Well,
we're here. So funny. I am in the area. But yeah, the other thing was that it got built and got done pretty close to the weekend we went up.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I didn't have time to do it because we were moving.
Yeah, we just moved.
And then the date that everyone could do was earlier than I expected. So right. I was like, oh shit, this needs to happen now.
Kick it into high gear, folks. Yeah. it was beautiful. I'm so happy. And the ring is gorgeous. I mean, if you're interested, go check out my Instagram. So it's beautiful.
Yeah. So yeah, now we get to wedding plan.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
You know, and we get to field all of those questions too.
Well, let's take 5 seconds to just be engaged.
Yeah, I know. I literally got asked. So we were wine tasting. I think I told you this, but we were wine tasting and my friend and I went to go buy a bottle. And I told whoever was selling it to us, you know, chatting us up. And I mean, the engagement came up.
Right.
Obviously.
Of course, we're here celebrating.
And first she thought that I got engaged to our friend.
Right.
Which was funny.
Yeah.
And then she asked when the wedding was. And I was like, literally, I don't even know if it's been 24 hours.
But even more ridiculous than that was the server at our restaurant that we went to. Because we got engaged and then went immediately to dinner. And our server was like, when's the wedding? And I was like, Miss Girl, we got engaged 10 minutes ago. Like, quite literally 10 minutes ago. I don't know.
Yeah, so.
But thank you for the enthusiasm.
Right, she's very excited. That's good.
Yeah.
But my new line is that if you ask me about the wedding, I will say it's taken care of. We've thought of all the details, so much so that you don't need to worry about it.
I think that that's a crazy take, because people are going to be like, well, then tell me all the details now.
It's okay.
Don't worry about it.
I got it.
It's a surprise.
I got it.
Okay.
We figured it out.
All right. Well, anyway, that's our good thing. And thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this story. If you would like to check out all the bonus content we have and vote on stories you want to hear, head over to Patreon at patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. If you or anyone you know has a story of survival or something crazy that's happened to you or them and you'd like to share it with us and possibly hear it on an upcoming listeners episode, send it to notodaypodcast@gmail.com. We have a TikTok that is Not Today Podcast and a Twitter that is Not Today Podcast, but the T on the podcast is a 3.
Because that makes sense.
And just keep breathing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hi there, my name is Annie Elise, aka your true crime BFF and host of the podcast Serialously. I have been a true crime enthusiast forever, but I wished somebody would break down the cases for me like a friend, giving all the details and discussing every twist and turn. So I decided to create a podcast that does just that. Serialously with Annie Elise is topping the charts with over 1 million weekly downloads. I do the deep dives in these cases so you don't have to, diving into all the raw details, saying what we're all thinking, and in a conversational way, just like having a conversation with your best friend. So join me and let's talk all things true crime. Serialously with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.